Good morning, I'm Emma Patterson with World Update from the BBC. A spate of shootings in East Timor leads to heightened tension on the island.
The situation remains very complex and very uncertain, but certainly the achievement of peace and security throughout the town will be done as quickly as possible.
Pioneering surgery brings new hope for infertile couples and the chance to postpone the menopause. And Hanover experiments with something between a bus and a taxi, which is steered by satellite.
We see that we have congestions on the roads. We feel to be in the right place in between the buses and in servicing those areas where the buses can't operate.
All that after the latest world news.
I'm Oliver Woods with the news from the BBC World Service. Sporadic bursts of gunfire have echoed through the streets of East Timor's capital, Dili, as multinational peacekeeping troops try to extend their hold over the city. There's been at least one confrontation between the troops and Indonesian army forces, but no casualties have been reported. David Willis reports from the capital, Dili.
A truck carrying Australian peacekeepers had just stopped at a roadblock as gunfire echoed from the other end of the street. The Australian soldiers sped off and we were forced to cower behind sandbags as a British Gurkha officer ordered his men to shoot anyone who attacked them. Three trucks bearing more than 20 militiamen came down the street firing into the air. The UN mandate only allows the peacekeepers to open fire if they or other people come under attack, so the militias passed by unimpeded and there was no return of gunfire.
The BBC's David Willis. The Indonesian Parliament has endorsed a controversial new state security bill. The bill, which has to be signed into law by President Habibie, has been fiercely criticised for giving the military sweeping powers under a state of emergency. There have been widespread protests against the move, and shortly after it was signed, Indonesian police fired tear gas and warning shots over the heads of a crowd of about 300 students attempting to march on the Parliament building in Jakarta. Hope is fading for the survival of hundreds of people still trapped in the rubble after the devastating earthquake that struck Taiwan on last Tuesday. Rescuers are still looking for survivors in the worst-hit central areas of the country, but frequent aftershocks have hampered their efforts. More than 100,000 people have been made homeless. Adam Brooks reports from the capital, Taipei.
As Taiwan moved into the third day of exhausting rescue work, hopes were fading for the lives of those still trapped in the rubble. Occasional accounts emerged of people surviving their injuries, shock and dehydration to live this far, but rescuers said they were now pulling more dead than living from the ruins. Tremors continue to sweep across the island. Seismologists say they're diminishing in power, but that's no guarantee that they don't still pose a danger to already weakened structures.
The BBC's Adam Brooks. Funeral ceremonies have been held in Moscow for Raisa Gorbachev, the wife of the last Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. She died of leukemia on Monday in a German clinic. A brief memorial service at Mrs. Gorbachev's Moscow Foundation, where her body had lain in state, was attended by Mr. Gorbachev and other family members, together with Russian leaders, foreign dignitaries and ambassadors. President Yeltsin was attended by his wife, Nina. The time is coming up to 4 minutes past the hour. You're listening to the BBC News from our studios in London. I'm Oliver Woods. The Russian authorities say police have defused an explosive device planted in an apartment building in a town to the southeast of Moscow. The Ministry of Emergency Situations said the device included three sacks of an explosive mixed with sugar and had been timed to go off at dawn. The police were alerted by a resident who said he'd seen people unloading the sacks from a car with a covered number plate. A wave of bomb attacks this month has killed nearly 300 people and prompted the introduction of tighter security measures. An American spacecraft is due to arrive shortly over Mars, which will conduct a 2-year study of the climate on the planet. It's the culmination of a 9-month journey for the Mars Climate Orbiter. The NASA craft will be looking for traces of water on Mars, and it will send back daily photographs of the weather throughout the Martian year, which is nearly twice as long as the year on Earth. Corinne Podger of BBC Science reports.
Scientists already know that water once flowed on Mars, but they have yet to find out where it all went. NASA hopes the Climate Orbiter will solve that mystery and also reveal whether conditions on Mars might once have been able to support life. Nowadays, the planet's surface is a frozen wasteland, its atmosphere so thin that any water present freezes into ice or evaporates. But the planet does have ice clouds and dust storms, some so severe that they can cover the entire globe.
Corinne Podger reporting. A team of British and American doctors say they have carried out the first successful ovary graft, an operation which could have profound implications for reversing or delaying the effects of the menopause. The operation could pave the way for treating sterility caused by a premature menopause and protecting fertility in women undergoing chemical or radiation therapy for cancer. It is also possible that the treatment could be used to allow a woman to conceive at any age. The time's coming up to 6 minutes to the hour.
Thousands of students are reported to have clashed with security forces in Jakarta and Indonesia's second city of Surabaya. Today, the students took to the streets after Parliament passed a new security bill which will give greater powers to the military. The security forces are said to have fired warning shots over the heads of the demonstrators who were seeking to march on Parliament. On the line now from Jakarta is the BBC's Jim Fish. Jim, you're in the thick of it and the demonstration continues.
Very much so. I'm standing on a 12-lane highway in the centre of Jakarta, which has been completely blocked off by hundreds of riot police and troops. They're heavily armed with tear gas and automatic weapons. They've already had one clash with students who are trying to get past here from the other direction to get to Parliament to lodge their protest against the state security bill. They were prevented there. Police fired warning shots in the air. And I understand nine students were hurt, one of them by a rubber bullet. At the moment, the confrontation where I'm standing is tense, but it's not violent. But it looks as if the police are not taking any chances. They've got several lines of riot police backed up by troops behind them. Some of them are wearing their protective masks, gas masks, and it's quite clear that they're prepared to use tear gas if necessary.
And the students show no sign of a willingness to disperse.
No, the usual pattern of these demonstrations, which have been building up over the past week or 10 days, is that they confront the police for several hours. They take it in turns to come right up to the police cordon and then move back again. At the moment, they're in a phase of confrontation. That one of the most militant of the students' group, the Forum Quarter, they're right in the front line and they're taunting the police and the army, quite clearly trying to provoke them or wind them up. So it looks as if there might well be some further confrontation.
Essentially, this is an anti-military demonstration. Has public opposition to the army grown since the mayhem began in East Timor after the referendum?
It's interesting that East Timor is not really mentioned overtly, at least on any of the banners or the flags that they're waving. But I spoke to one of the leaders and he said, yes, we blame the army not for losing East Timor, but for being there in the first place. We don't blame the East Timorese for voting for independence. We want the army out of there. We want them out of our lives as well. But I think in general, this is not the mood of the general population. These are protests led by the students against giving the military wider powers. The general population doesn't really know much or care very much, I must say, about East Timor.
The BBC's Jim Fish reporting live from the demonstrations in Jakarta. Well, the Indonesian army is steadily pulling out of East Timor, but it's leaving behind a terrible mess. Today, there were tense standoffs and shootings in the capital, Dili. On one occasion, pro-Jakarta militias opened fire close to the checkpoint guarding the UN compound in East Timor. Our correspondent, Angus Roxburgh, is with the British regiment, the Gurkhas.
I'd arranged to go out on patrol with the Gurkhas this morning, but as I waited for them to get ready in their base near the UN compound, the sound of gunfire suddenly threw the whole place into panic. Across the sandbags where the Gurkhas crouched with their rifles poised, I saw a jeep and two trucks drive by, crammed with pro-Jakarta militiamen, guns pointed upwards.
Come on! enemy have been sighted over there. Okay, the militia have gone off in a vehicle. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to push round the back of these houses and see what they've been firing at.
The Gurkhas instantly spread out to secure all sides of their base. The commander, Major Tim Warrington, explained the situation.
The vehicle moved very, very quickly out of my area and headed due north into the area of the port, where they were also reported as firing shots into the air in the port area. They are now being intercepted, I believe, by Australian call signs in that area. My call signs attempted to intercept them by deploying forward since they were firing into the air. Firing into the air does not allow me to return fire to those suspected militia. The only abilities I have at this stage would be to attempt to detain them and arrest them. Were they to fire at me, at my men, at any of you or any civilians, then I would be within my rules of engagement to fire on them.
Any militia in there? If you will, go on to stop it, right?
The trucks raced off down towards the port area, where it would be up to Australian troops to stop them and disarm them if possible. But they haven't been doing too well so far. Their commander, General Peter Cosgrove, said this morning he was accelerating the arrival of more troops. Clearly, this peacekeeping operation is proving to be no walkover.
Our reporter, Angus Roxburgh from Dili. It's 11 minutes past the hour. You're listening to World Update from the BBC in London. I'm Emma Patterson. Rescue workers in Taiwan have been spending their third long, hard, disheartening day digging through the debris after the big earthquake. We've reached that point when finding survivors becomes a rare and almost miraculous event. Earlier, I spoke to Stanley Goh, a senior official at the Taiwanese Foreign Ministry, who's been working alongside the U.S. rescue teams now in Taiwan.
They continue their work around the clock. And earlier this morning, they have found successfully get him out to the hospital for treatment. And there's two other collapsing buildings, and the squad has been searching for potential survivors.
Is there a sense in Taiwan that the international community hasn't given as much priority to the earthquake in Taiwan as it might have done if it hadn't been for such a recent disaster in Turkey?
I've been with the American team for the last 48 hours, and my focus is primarily on the city here in the central part of Taiwan called Douliu. Very sure about the entire rescue mission, but here the Americans are doing an excellent job and the local people are very appreciative.
Is there a need for more international aid?
As far as the American assistance is concerned, they are coming with the 90-some personnel together with four dogs and all the high-tech equipment and all the things that they need. So as well as we are working with the Americans, things are going very satisfactory.
Obviously, the focus at the moment is the immediate humanitarian disaster, but what do you think will be the long-term impact of this earthquake?
I think this demonstrates once again this the humanitarian effort on the part of international community, and so people are very grateful. You know, in such a short notice, and less than 12 hours, the Americans will be able to put together a professional team and flying into our part of the world, and immediately after landing there on the site, help local authorities and help searching who are so worried and concerned about their families and their relatives.
That was the Taiwanese government official Stanley Goh. Thousands have gathered in Moscow for the funeral of Raisa Gorbachev, who died earlier this week after a long battle against leukemia. The coffin of the former First Lady was heaped with bouquets as mourners looked back at the Gorbachev era. Tributes have been surprisingly warm and generous, given that this was a nation which never really took to Raisa Gorbachev during her lifetime. William Horsey is on the line now and at the site of the funeral in Moscow. William, set to be a fit tribute for the former First Lady?
Yes, this is very fine a tribute in this historic cemetery built in the time of Peter the Great, cemetery that holds so many of the famous names of Russian and indeed Soviet history. At this moment, the graveside is awaiting, and 100 yards away, the procession is beginning on foot, led by a priest and with dignitaries from around the world by the graveside. The coffin is now being carried. It's come out of off the hearse, and it's being carried the last 100 yards to the graveside. We have the dignitaries lined up there. We're expecting some final words of tribute before the moment where Raisa Gorbachev is laid to rest.
Raisa Gorbachev was known as a stylish and outspoken woman, but she wasn't an Eva Peron. She wasn't adored during her lifetime, yet it seems that the mourning has been surprisingly passionate and moving.
Yes, I think this is explained by many here as a sort of Russian sense of emotion rather than a conversion. And many thousands of ordinary Russians, it's true, have paid tribute this morning. They were given a last chance to pay their respects with the lying in state being open to the public again. And many thousands wrote to the Gorbachevs while she was suffering in hospital in Germany. But still, many in this society would not recognize her as a great person. She is somebody who's divided the nation even as at her death.
William Horsley, thank you. That was the BBC's correspondent William Horsley reporting from Moscow. Now a look at what's making headlines around the world, and many papers are still preoccupied with the crisis in East Timor. The Sydney Morning Herald reports that the bodies of 30 tortured East Timorese have been found dumped in a well outside the home of an independence leader. The Herald correspondent in Jakarta says Australian officials are seeking to improve security at its embassy in the Indonesian capital following anti-Australian demonstrations. The New York Times discusses the decision of the federal government to bring a lawsuit against the tobacco companies. The paper quotes a former federal prosecutor saying, "I can't remember an entire industry that was targeted as if it was a racketeering enterprise. The chances of succeeding in a civil case are thought to be higher than in a criminal case because of the level of proof. They chose the easier route for them," the paper quotes the prosecutor as saying, "and very wisely, because criminal cases, by their very nature, are iffy." Many of the British papers have photographs of the singer Diana Ross leaving Heathrow Airport for New York after being detained by police. She'd been questioned about an alleged assault on a security worker after she'd objected to a body search. Beneath the headline, "You can't hurry love," The Guardian in London says such wild behaviour may be suitable for rock's young rebels, but the experience was too much for the 55-year-old singer. And we'll have more from the world's front pages later in the programme. It's coming up to, 18 minutes past the hour. And just a reminder, if you would like to drop us a line, you can do so. Our address is BBC World Service, P.O. Box 76, London, WC2B4PH, England, or the old email, worldservice, that's all one word, letters@bbc.co.uk. Now, with the latest headlines from the BBC, here's Oliver Woods.
The security situation is becoming increasingly difficult for the international peacekeeping force in East Timor, with militia fighters massing near the capital, Dili. As the search continues for survivors from Taiwan's earthquake, hope is fading that any more people will be found alive. And American and British doctors have pioneered surgery, which they say could reverse or delay the effects of the menopause. Emma.
Thanks, Oliver. You're listening to World Update from the BBC here in London. We'll be right back.
This is World Update from the BBC World Service. This morning, there is news of a medical breakthrough that could have enormous implications for women's health. Two doctors, one in Britain and one in the US, have carried out the first successful ovary graft on a 30-year-old American. The breakthrough could help some infertile couples. It could also be used to delay the menopause. To talk about this pioneering work, I'm joined now by Professor Ian Kraft, who's a specialist in fertility and gynecology at the London Fertility Centre. Professor Kraft, firstly, can you explain fairly briefly the basic procedure that was carried out?
Well, Professor Gosden has been interested in this subject area for a long period of time, and so have many of us, particularly for women who are going to have chemotherapy and radiotherapy for cancer or leukemia in order to try and preserve ovarian tissue, store it in the freezer, and then to introduce it back into the woman. So in reality, it's like giving someone a graft of their own tissue, an autograft. It's not having blood this time, but having your own ovary tissue back. The tissue's probably been collected from the lady concerned laparoscopically, I presume. Or if it hasn't been collected laparoscopically but at open operation, it can be replaced laparoscopically. That's a little telescope inserted through the umbilicus, the navel, and suturing it onto the pelvic sidewall, although others have tried to put it on the uterus itself, on the womb. And the whole concept is to try and get a blood supply to it and to see if it will then function.
And this really is a huge leap forward, is it? I mean, it has significant practical...
I don't think it's a huge leap forward as the media would like you to believe. I think what it is, it's a first step to show you can get ovarian functioning tissue. And I believe the lady concerned has made one egg in relation to some drugs that have been used to try and promote an egg development. Whether you can get a very effective production of the major female hormone, which is called estradiol, and whether you can get good production of eggs on a regular monthly basis is really what's essential from a fertility perspective, or indeed whether the ovarian tissue will respond to the drugs you normally use for test tube type treatment has yet to be seen. But obviously it is one approach.
And there is the possibility that tissue can be transplanted from another donor.
No, and that's not really what the concept is. I mean, they aren't as a possibility, but you would have all the problems that you would have with ordinary acceptance of foreign tissue. So you would have to have immunosuppression for that from one individual to another. And that's why, to a large extent, most policies trying to assist women become pregnant not using donated ovarian tissue have relied on donated eggs. You don't have this problem, but you would have the problem of suppression if you had to accept your ovarian tissue from somebody else.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you. That was Professor Ian Kraft, a specialist in fertility and gynecology at the London Fertility Centre. This is World Update with Emma Patterson. Tensions rise in East Timor as international peacekeepers and Indonesian militia come close to open confrontation. We hear about a new type of German bus fitted with satellite navigation systems and Mars. It's icy, it's cold, but NASA still thinks it's worth a closer look. But first, this news.
I'm Oliver Woods with the news from the BBC World Service. Sporadic bursts of gunfire have echoed through the streets of East Timor's capital, Dili, as multinational peacekeeping troops try to extend their hold over the city. There's been at least one confrontation between the troops and Indonesian army forces, but no casualties have been reported. After shots were fired near the harbour, British soldiers were given orders to shoot back if necessary. Lieutenant Commander Tony Crump is with the UN forces in Dili.
It certainly wasn't an attack. The weapons weren't pointed at any of the peacekeepers. I think it's more testing our resolve, and the Gurkhas are very up for the task. They're out there looking, and if they do come across any militiamen, they will act appropriately.
Lieutenant Commander Tony Cramp. The Indonesian Parliament has endorsed a controversial new state security bill. The bill, which is to be signed into law by President Habibie, has been fiercely criticised for giving the military sweeping powers under a state of emergency. There have been widespread protests against the move, and shortly after it was signed, Indonesian police fired tear gas and warning shots over the heads of a crowd of about 300 students attempting to march on the Parliament building in Jakarta. Hope is fading for the survival of hundreds of people still trapped in the rubble after the devastating earthquake that struck Taiwan last Tuesday. Rescuers are still looking for survivors in the worst-hit central areas of the country. The Taiwanese government's efforts are directed at distributing food, medicine and blankets to more than 100,000 people, but frequent aftershocks have hampered the rescue efforts. A team of British and American doctors say they have devised medical treatment which could delay the effect of the female menopause. The treatment could delay the menopause by as long as 10 years and allow older women to conceive. Dr. Kutluk Oktay of the New York Methodist Hospital carried out the first successful ovary transplant.
What we managed to do with this operation is that being able to return the ovarian functions to a young woman who lost them due to a surgical procedure, and that way that person can have menstrual cycles and ovulate and possibly in the future get pregnant.
Dr. Kutluk Oktay. An American spacecraft is due to arrive shortly over Mars, which will conduct a two-year study of the climate on the planet. It's the culmination of a nine-month journey for the Mars Climate Orbiter. The NASA craft will be looking for traces of water on Mars, and it will send back daily photographs of the weather throughout the Martian year, which is nearly twice as long as the year on Earth. It will also be looking for traces of water to help try to find out whether life ever existed there. Funeral ceremonies have been held in Moscow for Raisa Gorbachev, the wife of the last Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. She died of leukemia on Monday in a German clinic. A brief memorial service at Mrs. Gorbachev's Moscow Foundation, where her body had lain in state, was attended by Mr. Gorbachev and other family members, together with the Russian leaders and foreign dignitaries and ambassadors. As some news just in, Russian warplanes and artillery have been active against targets in the southern breakaway Republic of Chechnya. A Russian military spokesman was quoted as saying rockets and bombs were fired at guerrilla positions on Chechen territory. The news, that's it of the news, it's coming up to 4 minutes to the hour.
Massive aftershocks are still slowing rescue efforts in Taiwan, but the international rescue teams have now begun reaching the earthquake epicenter in central Taiwan. Japanese workers have been joined by other teams from around the world, including veterans from recent quakes in Turkey and Greece. A UN team was sent to coordinate the various rescue specialists after China, which, unlike Taiwan, is a UN member, approved the initiative. From Taipei, Jill McGivering has sent this report.
A rare moment of triumph as rescue workers lead an elderly man from the rubble of a collapsed building. 48 hours after this devastating earthquake, hundreds of people are still missing. Their chances of survival diminish with every passing hour. Every saved life brings a sense of euphoria. I'm so happy, cried this member of the rescue team. That man wasn't even injured at all. The county of Taichung is one of the worst affected. Roads and bridges are badly damaged. Details of casualties are still emerging. These central provinces have many remote towns and villages, some reduced to ruins by the force of the quake. Xie Maoming rushed here from Taipei when his family's home collapsed, injuring the whole family.
Just my sister Song is still here, and my brother's daughter is out but died. My mother is hurt, is now in hospital.
2,000 aftershocks, some of them earthquakes in their own right, have added to the sense of fear. Buildings, already in a weakened state, are in danger of further collapse as the tremors continue. Many people are too traumatized to risk going home at all. Ji Liao Deng has moved his whole family into tents on open ground. He said his family would be too terrified to go back home for another 1 or 2 weeks. The house might fall down, he said. Local people gave a hero's welcome to the international rescue teams flying into Taipei's international airport. Many are bringing specialist equipment and trained dogs. All bring valuable experience. The head of the British team, John Holland, says he's optimistic lives can still be saved.
Well, I think obviously as time moves on, then people's chances diminish. But as proved in Turkey recently, people are found quite a long time after 48 hours. So hopes are high at the moment.
The international support has brought fresh hope to people numbed by despair and disbelief. The number of dead is steadily growing. For those still trapped in crushed buildings, the next 24 hours and the success or failure of the rescue teams will be crucial.
That report from Jill McGivering. You're listening to World Update from the BBC. I'm Emma Patterson. Reports this morning that Russian planes have bombed targets at Grozny Airport, the first time such a raid has been made so close to Grozny since the 94-96 war between Chechens and Russian troops. A Russian military spokesman was quoted as saying rockets and bombs were fired at guerrilla positions on Chechen territory as part of continuing efforts to avert a third incursion by Islamic rebels into neighbouring Dagestan. Chechnya is a place fewer outsiders venture into because of the rash of kidnappings and murders there. But Alex Smales, a journalist with the agency Sigma, has just returned from a visit. He managed to interview the rebel leader Shamil Basayev, whose forces took on the Russians recently in Dagestan. BBC's Joanna Buchan asked him to describe Grozny, the Chechen capital, devastated during the Republic's war with Russia 3 years ago.
Central Grozny is still very much damaged. There's been no rebuilding whatsoever. What they have done is made the best use of what they can. There's a bit of electricity in certain houses which they generate themselves. They link up their own lines. You'll have one flat right next to a completely open, damaged space. People selling things openly on the street. I mean, there's a lot of food around. There's open trade with Russia. They are managing to bring in products from the outside. But the main thing was water. People seem to be having to collect water from wells.
What about, though, reports we've had here of continuing Russian bombing and attacks on Chechnya itself?
I visited one region called Sezhenyut, which had been attacked on the 10th and also on the 12th by Russian jets at night time. There was a stretch of road between 10 and 12 houses were completely destroyed. Civilians were still shifting through their possessions. There had been several casualties. And it was still very trashed. The trees were completely destroyed in the area. There was wide craters in the road.
Why that particular area? Why would the Russians attack there?
The Russians are claiming that they're hitting just military locations. On the way to that location, one of my guides did mention that Katab's training camp is in that location and pointed just down the alleyway to where it was. Katab is this so-called Jordanian or Saudi-sponsored second-in-command to Basayev. He's another warlord, basically.
So they told you there was a training camp further down, but obviously wherever the Russians had attacked, it hadn't actually hit the training camp.
It definitely hadn't hit the training camp. These were civilian houses. I didn't see any fighters or mujahideen or any combatants at all in that area. It was old women, families.
What did Basayev have to say about these attacks?
He said they are calling us terrorists for hitting Moscow, but this is state terrorism in Chechnya.
Did he say anything? Did he admit responsibility for the bombings across Russia?
He was adamant that they were not responsible for it and it came from within Russia and the KGB were behind it and other powers that be, and it was a bigger business than just terrorism from within Chechnya.
Photojournalist Alex Smales talking to the BBC's Joanna Buchan. Minutes to the hour. I'm Emma Patterson with World Update from the BBC. Shots rang out across the East Timorese capital, Dili, today. The incidents of violence appear to be growing. International peacekeepers are preparing themselves for the worst. The head of the multinational force in East Timor says he plans to speed up the deployment of his troops on the island. To get a clearer picture of the situation on the ground, I spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Duncan Lewis, spokesman for the Australian contingent and based in Canberra.
The initial lodgement of the force was very quiet, but certainly in the last 24 hours or so there are a number of incidents which have occurred. This is largely attributable to the fact that the population has started to return to Dili. You may recall the streets were pretty deserted for the first day or two, but now people are starting to drift back into the city, and clearly among those folk there are people with arms and disruptive elements.
Have the international peacekeepers come under direct attack?
No, they haven't at this stage. The firing that occurred down on the docks earlier today was firing up in the air, and there's been no direct attack on Interfet personnel.
How complicated is the situation, given that we now have not only several military forces on the ground, but also civilians returning from the hillsides? Is that something that you would like to try and slow, at least for the time being, while the security situation remains so tenuous?
Emma, it is a particularly complex situation, but this level of complexity is nothing new for East Timor, I assure you. It has been a very confused and troubled place for a long time. We have factional rivalries, we have conflict between factions of militia, there is the complexity of Indonesian forces still in the area and Interfet, there's the complexity of the media, there is the complexity of the humanitarian assistance operation. All these things add to the complication of the exercise. What is important, however, is to realise that Interfet's mission is the establishment of peace and security, and the resolve to do that is very clear, and that will be achieved in as short a order as possible.
There is obviously enormous concern that the security situation could deteriorate. Your troops are now going to be deployed at a faster rate to ensure that there is some control on the ground?
The commander spoke at a press conference earlier today, Major General Cosgrove, and he said at that stage that he would be anxious to get as many troops into the area as he could within the constraints of those available. And so I would expect that there will be perhaps an acceleration of the program.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Duncan Lewis speaking to me from Canberra. Well, I'm joined now by our correspondent in Dili, David Lewis. David, any more trouble?
We're hearing reports of sporadic gunfire around the capital, Dili, but nothing as dramatic to report to you as the incident this morning in which three truckloads of militiamen came down the road firing into the air, openly firing into the air, and then went past the hotel here, the main hotel containing journalists, again firing openly into the air. They weren't impeded on their journey, although there were some very nervous Gurkhas and other members of the peacekeeping force around, keeping a very watchful eye on them, because the UN mandate only allows for the troops to open fire if there is a threat to life, and firing into the air is perceived as not create such a threat.
They haven't actually come under direct attack, but there are rumours, as I understand it, that the militia are planning to launch an attack on the capital.
That's right. We hear reports that up to 500 militiamen are gathering in a district called Lekisha, which is about 35 kilometres southwest of Dili, the capital, and that they are planning to launch an imminent attack on the capital here, and an imminent attack on the UN peacekeepers. It will be interesting to see as well what happens at the weekend when the last of the 4,000 remaining Indonesian army soldiers actually pulls out of East Timor.
That was our correspondent David Willis reporting from Dili. Well, now back to that breaking story. Russian forces are reported to have bombed the airport in the Chechen capital, Grozny. For the latest, I'm joined by our correspondent Paul Anderson in Moscow. Paul, any news on this supposed attack?
Well, the Russians operating out of military headquarters in the neighbouring Republic of Dagestan have confirmed that this attack did take place on the airport and on the area surrounding the airport in Grozny. They say that they were aiming at an ammunition dump and radar facility. It's not clear whether they succeeded in knocking these out, but the Chechens are saying that they did destroy one airplane and kill one technician who was working on the site.
And this is the first time that this kind of attack has taken place?
It's not the first time that the Russians have launched incursions into Chechen territory. They've been quite active on the border with Dagestan for the past couple of months or so, but it's the first time certainly that they've come as close to the centre of Chechnya, the seat of power in Chechnya, since the end of the war in 1996.
Paul, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much. That was our correspondent in Moscow, Paul Anderson. Time now now for a second look at what's making headlines around the world. The death of the Dutch journalist Sander Tunes in East Timor makes the headlines in many European papers. Tunes, who worked for the London Financial Times, was shot by gunmen while riding on the back of a motorcycle taxi in the suburbs of the capital, Dili. The Financial Times calls the 30-year-old Dutchman a foreign correspondent of outstanding potential, driven by a joyful curiosity and a determination to get to the bottom of the story. The paper expresses devastation at his death and disbelief at the wanton brutality of his passing. Beneath the headline, Sister Act in East Timor, the Washington Post explains how independence leaders succeeded in evading pro-Indonesian militias by hiding in a convent. The paper says the militiamen came to the Salesian Sisters convent in Dili four times, but the nun who answered the door insisted, "We have no one but women and children here." In fact, they had over 100 refugees, including leading members of the resistance movement. The New York Times reports on the FBI's decision to broaden its investigation into possible nuclear espionage by China, moving far beyond the earlier scrutiny of one single scientist. The paper says that the widened inquiry tacitly acknowledges that the initial investigation at the Los Alamos National Nuclear Laboratory was mishandled. Most French dailies take stock of Wednesday's experimental car-free day in the country's main cities. In town without my car? Good question. Bad answer, says the front page headline in Liberation. The paper describes the experiment as a semi-failure, noting that the shambles shows that surely there must be another solution to prevent road congestion. And that's what's making the headlines in the world's press today. And our look at the papers. It's coming up to 11 minutes to the hour. I'm Emma Patterson. This is World Update from the BBC. Now with the latest headlines from the BBC, here's Oliver Woods.
The security situation is becoming increasingly difficult for the International Peacekeeping Force in East Timor, with militia fighters massing near the capital, Dili. As the search continues for survivors from Taiwan's earthquake, hope is fading that many more people will be found alive. And American and British doctors have pioneered surgery, which they say could reverse or delay the effects of the menopause. Emma.
Thanks, Oliver. You're listening to World Update from the BBC here in London. It's called a bus, but it picks you up from home, and it's infuriated the taxi drivers of Hanover. The German city is running a controversial experiment using small buses fitted with satellite navigation systems to bridge the gap between public and private transport. So far, it's been limited to one district, but now Hanover's transport company wants to extend it to the whole of the city. Our transport correspondent Tim Hirsch has been taking a ride.
For Elsa Zau, an elderly widow living alone in Hanover, it's an ideal service. From her flat, she plans a shopping trip using public transport. A call is picked up by a control centre at the local bus depot, and her details entered into a computer system. The software is linked up to three small buses circulating in the area, and with the help of satellite navigation, it constantly updates their routes. These are relayed to the driver on a small dashboard monitor. Within a few minutes, the bus pulls up at Elsa's front door. She says this pickup system gives her mobility without the need for a car.
There is places where I want to go, there is no buses. When I go to my church, there is no bus. That means I must walk about 20 minutes.
Why is it better than a taxi, for instance?
The price. Here I pay 2 marks. From my home to wherever I want to go. And a taxi, you're not even in the taxi sitting, there is 4 marks. And then they don't want to drive you short ways. And then they make a face.
The pickup bus service is run by Hanover's Municipal Transport Company, but it's being promoted by Volkswagen, which makes the specially adapted Caravelle buses just outside the city. Josef Thomas of VW is in charge of the project.
We see that we have congestions on the roads. We see certain pressure on individual transportation. We see the limits of public transportation. We feel to be in the right place in between the buses and in servicing those areas where the buses can't operate.
So far, the pickup buses have only been allowed to operate for an experimental period in one section of the city. And Hanover's taxi firms used their political muscle to ensure they were kept well away from major transport interchanges like the main railway station. Now the bus company wants to widen the scheme to cover the whole of Hanover. Taxi drivers at the station rank are not impressed.
This is a small city, not a big place, and there are already more than 1,000 taxis. That's enough.
Whoever came up with this new project didn't think about the taxi drivers. We have to make a living too.
This system has no future because the customers have to wait too long.
The bus company's hope is that these doubts can be overcome by taking the taxi firms into partnership and sharing out some of the calls. If they succeed, it will provide the first real test of this kind of flexible bus system in an urban area. And according to its supporters, it will show other cities how technology can help to break down the barriers between private and public transport.
That was our report from Germany on a new type of bus they're hoping to launch there. Well, a US spacecraft is in the final stages of its marathon journey to the Red Planet. Mars Climate Orbiter has travelled more than 670 million kilometres in the 9 months since it was launched. It was due to have gone into orbit around Mars about now. Well, I am joined by the BBC space expert Martin Redfern. How's it going?
Well, we've just heard that the Mars Climate Orbiter has indeed fired its engines to put it into orbit around Mars. That doesn't mean to say it's arrived and that's all complete. It's got to slowly make its orbit lower and lower and more circular and nearer the surface. It'll be doing that over the next month. And then in December, actually, there's another probe arriving, and that's actually a lander. And the first thing that the orbiter's going to do is to act as a sort of satellite relay craft for messages from that lander. That lander, they hope, is going to land near the edge of the southern polar ice cap on Mars and possibly say some very interesting things about that area, which is an area that hasn't been visited at all so far.
Well, what are we looking for?
Primarily, actually, on this mission, we're looking for water. That's the clue to everything about Mars. There's a lot of evidence from the Mars Global Surveyor, which is already going around, has been going around Mars for a couple of years, sending back some really wonderful, wonderfully detailed pictures. There's clues from that that there were not only flash floods on Mars, but possibly once oceans and rivers and all sorts of things. The question is now, where did the water go? Is some of it still locked up underground on Mars? And if there was water around there once, then did it harbour life? And also, where the water went, what happened to the life? The other thing that's really interesting is that Mars is a little bit like Earth. It beckons us because it could be our future if we're not careful. Will our water disappear one day? What will we do then? Can we do something to prevent it? Could we one day use Mars as a home? Could we bring water back to the surface? And of course, if there's vast quantities locked just beneath the surface in ice, then all that becomes a possibility.
Well, is this going to revive public interest in the Red Planet? I mean, we were all hoping to see little green men on this romantic planet we had sort of various kind of illusions about. Now we discover that it's frozen, it's icy, it's cold, it's a bit hostile. Is this going to sort of generate a new wave of public interest, do you think?
I don't know that this mission alone is, but I think there is already a lot of interest there. It was rekindled with the arrival of Mars Pathfinder, the craft that landed with its little robot that went out and sniffed at the rocks and so on. It was brought into further excitement with the Mars meteorite and the possible signature of life from in that. that sort of issue is only going to be answered if we actually get samples from the surface, either to analyse there or, better still, to bring back. The trouble is, it looks as if the States is cutting their funding from that sort of mission, the sample return missions in the future. But there's a huge psychological need, I think, for people to know, are we alone in the universe, even if the company is only bacteria? And the question then is, are we chemically the same as those bacteria? Was life on Earth perhaps seeded from Mars, or did it originate in two separate places entirely independently? And if that's the case, then it's likely to have originated in all sorts of other planets in other solar systems, and the universe could be teeming with life.
We wait to find out. Thank you very much. That was the BBC's Martin Redfern from our science department. And here's a final look at today's main news on World Update. While sporadic gunfire has been echoing in the East Timorese capital, Dili, the Indonesian parliament in Jakarta has passed a stringent security bill amid growing protests against the army. Indonesian students have marched on parliament.
About a third of them are in camps that the government has set up, the largest of which is about maybe 12,000 people. The rest are much smaller in schools or dormitories or stadiums. They have enough food, but they are in crowded conditions.
That was our correspondent there. As hopes fade that any more survivors will be found from Taiwan's earthquake, the authorities have arrested a builder alleged to be responsible for illegal construction. That's all from World Update for today. Join me tomorrow for the latest world news from the BBC here in London. I'm Emma Patterson, in for Vicky Barker. Good morning.